From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Shamans and Medicines. Here's what's happening. My gosh, when does it end? Worldwide, there is an alarming surge in coronavirus cases, and health experts are saying a key factor in the latest wave is the very highly contagious Delta variant. Now, this variant is spreading about 55% faster than the original strain that was first identified in the United Kingdom late last year, according to the World Health Organization. And that strain spreads about 50% faster than the version that first began infecting people in late 2019. What a mess. And how is the virus spreading so rapidly? One study suggests that the Delta variant may transmit faster than other strains because it makes more copies of itself inside people's bodies at a faster rate. Now, when scientists in China compared dozens of cases of Delta to strains from early in the pandemic, they found that patients with a Delta variant had viral loads that were 1,260 times higher. My gosh. Tampa Bay, Florida is battling a unique combination of three separate respiratory illnesses, causing mass hospitalizations there. Area doctors are calling it a horrible triple threat. Two doses of Pfizer or AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine, they say, are nearly as effective against the highly transmittable Delta coronavirus variant as they are against the previously dominant Alpha variant, a study published on Wednesday has shown. Officials say vaccines are highly effective against the Delta variant, now the dominant variant worldwide, as I mentioned, though the study reiterated that one shot of the vaccine is not enough for high protection. We assigned Howard Bloom to the story. Howard, what do you got for us this week on this thing?
Well, first off, headlines are giving the impression that the Delta variant of the COVID virus is already causing a fourth wave of the COVID pandemic, complete with massive numbers of hospitalizations and deaths. And that's not true, at least not yet. COVID deaths are down to 300 a day. That's a tiny fraction of the 5,000 deaths a day of 5 months ago.
That's right.
On the other hand, the number of new cases is reaching a frightening peak. It's coming close to 50,000 a day. But that's also a radical decrease from the 300,000 a day a year and a half ago. Here's what should concern you and me about this potential new COVID wave. In mid-June, only 10% of the COVID cases in the United States came from the Delta variant. As of this morning, the Delta variant was up to 83%. And the Delta variant spreads 2 to 3 times faster than older versions of COVID for a simple reason that you just mentioned. A new study from the Chinese Guangdong Provincial Center for Disease Control and Prevention shows that the Delta variant creates 1,000 times more copies of itself in your respiratory tract as previous forms of the COVID virus. One result is that a year ago, COVID struck down primarily the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions. With a Delta variant, that's no longer true. The Delta variant is hospitalizing and killing people in their 30s and 40s who have no pre-existing conditions and are healthy and strong, and there's a twist. So far, new Delta variant deaths are skipping over those who are fully vaccinated. Yes, the vaccinated are not being killed by COVID. 99.5% of the new COVID deaths are among those who refused vaccination or ignored it, says Dr. Brittany Cobia of the Grandview Medical Center in Birmingham, Alabama. I'm admitting young, healthy people to the hospital with very serious COVID infections. One of the last things they do before they're put on an incubator is beg me for the vaccine. I hold their hand and tell them that I'm sorry, but it's too late, which is why Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said last week that the new outbreak of hospitalizations and deaths is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Yes, the number of COVID cases and deaths is low compared to February, but there are stings in the tail of this new Delta variant. For example, children are an unrecognized COVID time bomb. The Federal Drug Administration has not yet approved vaccines for children under 12 and probably won't until the winter. But there's a shocking fact. 4 million children have come down with COVID so far. Children, meanwhile, fall is coming. Children are going back to school, and school could be the new super spreader, which is why the American Academy of Pediatrics is urging that all children over the age of 2 wear masks in school. We adults are also going to be trapped indoors again, breathing each other's air. We need to vaccinate 70% of our population to have herd immunity by September. Alas, we are not even at 50%. What's worse, as long as this virus continues to spread, it will continue to produce new variants. It'll produce new mutations until we vaccinate not just America, but the world. Now, why the world? Because someday, one of the new variants from an unvaccinated country could devastate America the way the Delta variant from India is devastating us now. And that new variant from another country could be inventive enough to end run our best weapon of defense, our vaccines.
Thank you, Howard. And I want to preface this by saying that Howard believes in the vaccine. A lot of people don't. And you make up your own mind. You do your own research because it's a very difficult decision on just what to decide. According to the USGS, there's a 70% chance that one or more quakes of a magnitude 6.7 or larger will occur before the year 2030. Two earthquakes have previously been data classified as big ones, the San Francisco quake in 1906 with a magnitude of 7.8 and the Fort Tejon quake in 1857 that hit 7.9. Cal Ory wrote the book, The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, about the late geologist Jim Berkland, who used to be on our show quite a bit, who predicted earthquakes. Through her research for the book, she discovered that she, too, can sense imminent shakers. She is one of the earthquake sensitives, humans who have been shown an ability to detect precursors that signal an upcoming quake. So let's bring her in for a moment. Cal, how are you, and do you sense anything happening?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, boy.
It's funny. Well, that's not funny. Last time I was on, I wanted to say water, but I didn't. And then we had a swarm at Lake Tahoe where I live out in the lake. I've never experienced that. That could cause a sage. And then we did have the 6.0 about 50 miles south from me. That was sharp. I'm telling you, that was the strongest quake I've felt since the Loma Prieta in 89. That was scary. I mean, that was really, really scary. That was a few weeks ago. But what I'm seeing right now, definitely California, I'm holding on to that. But I'm seeing that it's going to be near water. And you're probably thinking, well, every place in California is near water. So I'm going to narrow it down, the Salton Sea, near the San Andreas Fault Line,
okay,
and which the majority of seismologists would agree with.
Are you predicting a size, Cal?
Yeah, what you're saying. I mean, a major quake, 7.0 plus, for sure. Salton Sea, the Bay Area, these are the hot spots. I'm going to say California-Nevada border near Lake Tahoe and offshore Northern California. A 7+ before the year is over. 80%. I'm really convinced. And after that 6.0, it's not fun. It really isn't. So just be prepared. It'll give you peace of mind.
All right, Cal. Thank you so much. Cal Ory, she's predicting earthquakes. You know, a lot of people predict earthquakes because this planet has earthquakes every day, but they're not specific like Cal Ory is. Cal picks the place. She picks the time. Other earthquake predictors merely say there's going to be a big earthquake, and you never know where it's going to be the next day. So she's the real deal. Up next, Michael Cremo joins us, the forbidden archaeologist, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We've got a fascinating program for you today. And up front, Michael Cremo joining us, the forbidden archaeologist, hailed as a groundbreaking research pioneer, international authority in archaeological anomalies. His landmark bestseller, Forbidden Archaeology, first published back there in 1993, already translated into at least 26 languages, challenged the very foundation of the Darwinian evolution. Michael continues to dig up all kinds of discoveries in the fossil record and shake up accepted paradigms. Michael, welcome back to the program. Always good to have you.
Great to be back.
What have you been working on these days?
Oh, I'm always collecting new cases to put in some of my writing. So I've been working on that. And also, you know, keeping track of reactions to my work from various various parties, including scientists, archaeologists, historians of science, philosophers of science. So always busy with something.
Every time I see a story about some ancient civilization or a discovery of some humanoid from way gone back, I always say Michael Cremo was right. He was right about this one. He was right about that. You seem to be getting vindicated quite a bit.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of the ideas that we put out in Forbidden Archaeology are now becoming mainstream to some extent. I think they're making tiny steps in the right direction. You know, for example, when I was writing Forbidden Archaeology in the late 1980s, and at that time, they were saying humans like us first appeared 100,000 years ago. And in Forbidden Archaeology, we said, no, 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 we've been around for a lot longer than that. So then in the 1990s, they started saying, well, 200,000 years. And then more recently, they're saying 300,000 years humans like us have been around. So they're making progress. They're going in the right direction, but I think they've got a long way to go before they really understand the real history of our human species.
Michael Cremo with us. And Michael, you've been looking at something called knowledge filtration. What exactly is that, and what are scientists doing with this?
Well, that's a really fascinating question. It has something to do with the fact that the theoretical preconceptions that scientists have will influence how they treat different categories of evidence that come to their attention. Evidence that conforms to the dominant consensus in a scientific field, whether it's archaeology or physics or anything else, evidence that conforms to the dominant consensus theory will pass through this intellectual filter very easily, which means you read about it in the textbooks, you'll see scientists talking about it at their conferences. But if there's evidence that contradicts the dominant theory or paradigm, it's sometimes called, that is ruling a scientific discipline at a particular point in time, that evidence will be filtered out, even though it may be reported by professional scientists, be of very good quality. If it doesn't fit the paradigm, it will be forgotten, set aside, explained away in some very flimsy way. So it's something that we really do have to be aware of.
And some key possibilities could get tossed out because of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the reason I started looking into that is because when I started looking into the history of archaeology, I was looking for reports of evidence that humans like us have existed for vast periods of time, not just a short period. And you don't see any evidence like that in today's textbooks. But when I looked back into the original reports by archaeologists, going back 10, 20, 30, 40, 100, 200 years, I found dozens of reports of very prominent scientists, archaeologists, geologists, and others giving evidence in the form of human bones, human artifacts, human footprints, millions of years old. And I had to wonder, well, if this evidence is there in the original reports, then why isn't it in the textbooks? You wouldn't even know it existed.
Yeah, what are they afraid of?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think in one sense, it's human nature. For example, if I love somebody and somebody tells me something bad about the person that I love, Well, you know, I may become a little upset with the person who's telling me these things, just become a little angry.
Sure.
You know, so I think that that's an element. But I think there's also an element of power that, you know, if you have a monopoly in the education system, as the mainstream group in science has today, you want to keep your monopoly. Like if you have a monopoly in a certain sector of the economy, or you have a monopoly on anything, you want to keep that, you know, on political power in a country or state or city or whatever. If you've got a monopoly, you don't like it when there's competition. So that, I think there's a lot of things involved in why it goes on, but those are some of them that I think are involved.
How has academia handled your theories, your books, Forbidden Archaeology, Mr. Science, My Religion, Human Devolution? How has academia handled that?
Well, I see three basic reactions from them. There's one group that I call the fundamentalist materialist. They don't like what I say. They don't want to hear it. They don't want anyone else to hear it. So that's one group. That's one reaction. They have very negative reaction. There's another group. They are maybe supporters of the current dominant theories, but for more or less scientific reasons. The first group, I think it's not purely scientific reasons why they object. It's more ideological with them. Yeah, you know, they have a prior commitment to a certain very limited, restricted, materialistic, physicalist picture of reality, and they don't like anything that challenges it. So this other group, they're supporters of the current theories, but they're willing to listen to alternatives, which I think is an important first step. So they will acknowledge actually good things about my work in their academic publications, their reviews of Forbidden Archaeology or Human Devolution. And it's members of that group who will also invite me to speak at universities. They'll accept my proposal.
Oh, that's good.
Present papers at their professional conferences. And sometimes they'll even publish those papers.
And they don't attack you in public or anything like that, do they?
No. They may disagree with me, but they're open-minded enough to listen to an alternative. And if I've done something that's valuable or useful for their discipline, they're prepared to acknowledge it. So that is, you know, I think if ideas are going to change, the very first thing is scientists have to be willing to listen to alternatives, and some of them are. And then there's the group that it's very small, very tiny, the ones that actually agree with me. Here I'm talking about, you know, professional scientists, academics. As far as the general public goes, they're on my side, basically.
What was it that you saw, Michael, many, many years ago that convinced you that civilizations were way older than what modern science was telling us?
Well, the first thing that influenced me was the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, especially the historical writings, which are called the Puranas. And in those writings, I found accounts of civilizations, of human populations on this planet, not on just on this planet, but actually all over the cosmos, that have been around for a long, long time.
Flying machines and everything else, too, in there, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah. Flying machines, they were called Vimanas. It was pretty amazing. So I thought, if I had had that alternative perspective, I wouldn't have had any reason to even doubt or question what I had learned from my teachers in high school or professors at the university that I went to. Wouldn't have had any reason to question them at all on these.
Hold on for a second, Michael. We're at the break. We'll come back and talk more about that. Plus, I want to get your reaction to the report that came out a month ago on unidentified aerial phenomena. We call them UFOs. The government calls them exactly UAPs. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Michael Cremo. One of his books, of course, The Forbidden Archaeologist. Books are all available through his website, Amazon. Just go check them out. Michael, about a month ago, the government released its report on unidentified aerial phenomena, and it didn't really say too much. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that. There was so much hype. You know, everyone was expecting something more than I think actually happened. All they essentially said is what they've always been saying. Yeah, there are unidentified aerial phenomena, but they're not ready to say these things are made by intelligent beings from other planets. It seems the most they're willing to say is, well, yes, there are some things we can't explain at the present moment, but we think we will be able to explain them. And you know, they may be aerial phenomena, you know, weather phenomena, you know, something like that, or perhaps technological developments made by other countries like China and North Korea or Russia, for example, or perhaps different agencies of our own government have these technologies that they have developed. That's basically what they said. And there may be some things that we can't explain at the present moment, but the explanations are most likely to be the ones I just listed.
Yep, absolutely. So, and were you disappointed in the report?
I kind of expected it in advance for it to be pretty much what it was. I think I may have even said so on some interviews that I did in the months leading up to the release. So I wasn't very surprised. Now, as far as I'm concerned, there are UFOs that come from other planets, other dimensions. I think they do exist. And yeah, there may be some scientists, a few of them, that are prepared to admit that. Now, for example, there was this Professor Loeb, Avi Loeb from Harvard University,
yes,
the astronomy department there, a couple years ago, yeah, when this object flew by the Earth called the, I think it's called the Oumuamua,
whatever it is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he said that could very likely be a probe from another planet in another solar system. Not our own, that entered our solar system, and it's being propelled by solar winds. And, you know, so there are some few scientists who are prepared to admit these things. But I think this most recent report, although it's good in the sense that they acknowledge that some of these unidentified aerial phenomena were recorded by military pilots.
That's right.
Did show up on radar. They did make some interesting admissions, but as far as what they actually are, I don't think that any expectations that they were going to say these are extraterrestrial objects made by some extraterrestrial intelligence. I don't think that if anybody was expecting that, it didn't happen.
Michael, before the break, when you were talking about the ancient Sanskrits, didn't Robert Oppenheimer, the father of our atomic bomb, use those Sanskrits to prove to himself that there was an atomic bomb detonated way gone back?
It appears that way. And in addition to being a great physicist who was part of the American program to develop an atomic bomb during World War II, in addition to being a physicist, he was a student of the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. And when the first atomic bomb, well, supposedly the first atomic bomb was tested at Alamogordo in New Mexico in 1945, he was in the bunker when it was set off. And there was this huge flash of light and huge blast, and you know he began quoting some Sanskrit verses from a text called the Bhagavad Gita, and you know, where it compared this to the light of a million suns. They were describing a weapon that, you know, these ancient Sanskrit writings describe a weapon that was used in ancient times called the Brahmastra. And in the Puranas and the Bhagavad Gita, you know, there are verses that say when such a thing happens, it's like you have a million suns all in one place. You know, so you can imagine the power of a million suns. That sort of sounds like pretty much what happens when an atomic bomb is set off. So yeah, he was interested in that. And actually, I've got an offer on my website. Anybody gets my most recent book, My Science, My Religion, from my website, mcremer.com, will be able to get a free copy of Bhagavad Gita. And
you still there, Michael?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe I lost you. Let me ask you this. What is called the science term epistemology?
Well, that's the branch of philosophy that tells us how we know what we think we know. So it's really a foundational issue in science. How do we get knowledge? What's evidence? What's not evidence? That's the whole branch of science and philosophy that deals with that question. And part of that has to do with what actually exists. Now, many scientists today are committed to an epistemology that recognizes only the existence of gross physical matter. They're not prepared to accept the existence of consciousness as something that can exist apart from matter. So if they start out with that assumption, it kind of limits the kinds of explanations they can offer for things. And they're having a big problem accounting for the existence of consciousness in that way. They keep trying to show that it's just the result of chemical interactions in the brain, but they've never been able to demonstrate that, actually. So it's something that, you know, we have to be aware of, you know, that if we have certain preconceptions about what the limits of evidence are, then we can't really say we're considering all the possibilities.
Michael Cremo with us, the Forbidden Archaeologist. We're going to take calls next hour with Michael, so make sure you're part of the program on that. What would you say is one of the most compelling cases from Forbidden Archaeology that you really just think this is it?
Well, I think one of the really compelling cases is the discoveries that were made in the Red Crag Formation in England, on the east coast of England. These discoveries were made in the 1920s by a researcher named James Reed Moore, Moyer, M-O-I-R. He was an investigator who did research in the Red Crag Formation, which according to modern geologists is about 2 million years old. And there had been some previous discoveries in this formation at a place called Foxhall in eastern England. For example, a human jawbone was found in the Red Crag at Foxhall, 16 feet deep in the Red Crag Formation. And as I said, you know, scientists today think that formation is about 2 million years old, and maybe even older. So to have humans existing 2 million years ago completely contradicts the now dominant theories. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. J. Reed Moore had also discovered all kinds of stone tools and artifacts in those formations. And an international commission of scientists, of the leading archaeologists and geologists of Europe, gathered together to judge this case. And they concluded it was genuine, you know, that these discoveries made by J. Reed Moore are genuine discoveries, but it sort of got swept under the rug, you know, by this process of knowledge filtration, so that, you know, these discoveries aren't really mentioned anymore. So that I found to be quite a significant case, because it's very well documented.
In your opinion, where does this take us in the future with regards to a civilization or civilizations that were much older than what most people think? What do you think happened to them, Michael? Where'd they go?
Very interesting question. And where it leads, I believe, is that it leads to an understanding that there's a cyclical aspect to time. You know, Western science was basically based on linear time, which comes out of the Judeo-Christian cosmology. Basically, they had a picture in that cosmology where things happen in a linear fashion. God creates the universe, then God creates the first living things, the plants, and then the animals, and then the human beings. And the human beings are in a fallen state, so they have to be delivered. So a Messiah comes to deliver them. And then there's a final judgment, and then it's all over. And it just happens once, and it happens in that very linear way. So modern science basically accepted it, because it grew up in Europe at a time when it was under this Judeo-Christian cosmology, and they more or less just adopted the same story, but stripped God and the soul out of it, so that they have the universe pops into existence by the Big Bang, not that God creates it just happens. And then
which I still don't understand, by the way. The Big Bang, I just will never get.
Yeah. That's a whole different question. Forbidden. Yeah,
that's two shows all by itself.
Yeah, that could be a show all by itself. So basically, first the plants come, then the animals, then the human beings, and they're in a fallen state, and they're going to be saved by science, and then it's going to be all over. of the heat death of the universe. And it's basically the same story. But in other cultures, there's the idea of cyclical time, that things happen again and again and again. You know, it's like, you know, in Plato's work, the Timaeus, is one of the dialogues of Plato. He talks about the Greek politician, Solon, who went to Egypt and was talking to the Egyptian priest about the history of Greece. And he was explaining how, yeah, in the beginning, there was a first man and first woman, and then civilization arose. And the Egyptian priest told him, you've just got part of your history. Here in Egypt, we have records of your history going back far before you've just, you're just recording what happened after the last devastation. You know, so the Egyptians, they had this cyclical concept of time, that, you know, there were civilizations in the past, they were destroyed, then civilization arose again and again and again.
Hold on, Michael. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come back and chat more and take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.